listening to Peaches Aren't the Only Fruit podcast, a podcast in which we discuss Amazon Prime's A League of Their Own TV series. I'm Karen. I'm here with Emma. Emma, we are talking about the last episode of this season today. I can't believe we're finally here. It's only 8 episodes, but it feels like it's taken forever.
I can't believe that we're here either. And we have been producing episodes on a pretty quick clip. Not super fast, but I mean, a pretty regular clip in terms of at least around every 2 weeks. Is that correct?
We were, and then we kind of got off cycle. But you know what? Let's be real about that. We got off cycle because we were thinking there wasn't going to be a season 2.
Yes,
it was demoralizing.
Okay. Absolutely. I think when we went in, we started with so much enthusiasm. And then you're right. It did get to be frustrating and disappointing when it was like, well, it's not going to get renewed. You know, we're still fans. We're still going to go through it. But then, like in our last mini-sode, a lot of big news came in.
Huge news, but also bad news. As we talked about in our last episode, what a weird year where all of these shows with diversity got canceled. And so we try and be happy that we got 4 episodes. But man, that's also kind of like a stab in the chest that we only got 4 episodes. And as I always like to point out, there are 10 Fast and the Furious movies. I mean, how furious can one really be?
That's a good point. That is a good point. Although those movies have probably come out now over like 20 years, which makes me feel like a dinosaur. But, you know, since our last mini-sode, has there been any official update on the production?
No. And you know what? That's really interesting too, isn't it? Because I feel like Amazon Prime not coming out to deny it is a quiet confirmation. But it is kind of weird. I was having a really interesting conversation yesterday with someone who's really involved in Hollywood. She's very senior. And she was talking about the cancellation of the L Word Generation Q. I said, you know, it's really weird that they announced that they were developing this, I don't know if you'd call it a spinoff or a reboot, a refocusing on the original cast members, now setting it in New York. I said, they didn't even have the viewership numbers to renew for season 3. They did it anyway. It got canceled because they definitely didn't have the numbers. Why would they do this spinoff? And she said, there's no way they're doing the spinoff. I think Showtime is just trying to kind of conceal the fact and make it not look like they're canceling all their diversity. They can quietly cancel it later. Yeah. You know, it would be interesting if that happened to A League of Their Own. Amazon Prime was trying to reduce pressure and then quietly canceled those 4 episodes later.
I hate to say that I still don't feel totally convinced that we're going to get those 4 episodes. I'm hopeful. And I agree with you. I think that not getting any more information seems like a quiet confirmation of it. But it would not surprise me if we get even more disappointed. And going back, not to retread everything from last episode, because we want to get into the finale, which had a big cliffhanger, spoiler alert, but probably if you're listening, you've seen it. But, you know, going back to the issue of whether it will be renewed, what do you think in terms of some of the things that might be holding it back? What do you think that they could cite? Do you think it's a matter of production costs? Do you think it's a matter of cast availability? Do you think it's a matter of viewership losing momentum? We talked a little bit about the viewership and how opaque it is with the streaming services, but any insight, thoughts you have there?
Yeah, actually, I'm glad you bring that up because the same conversation that I was having with this insider, she said A League of Their Own is really expensive. We don't realize that as we're watching because we're like, oh, they're like in 2 houses and on a playing field. But apparently it's a very expensive show. And so this gets into a conversation that we have had on this podcast before of if you're going to have a certain budget, you have to have the viewership to support that budget. And I think one of the conversations that shows sometimes have is, can they make it cheaper? I think this was a problem Sense8 had too. If you have this show, how do you make it cheaper? But one of the things about A League of Their Own is they already had some sunk costs. I noticed online, it looks like they custom built that ball field. I had just assumed that they used a pre-existing one.
Really? I had no idea, really.
Yeah, I think so. So if it's already built, it's a sunk cost. You don't have to rebuild it. Now, how do you minimize the other costs? I don't know. I don't think it's just a matter of reusing the same Cherry's dress that Carson wore all the time in season 1, but interesting question about how to reduce costs. So I think if Amazon were to come out and say we're canceling it, they might have to talk about this issue of viewers compared to budget. There's really not another conversation that you can have at this point.
Yeah, I mean, it's disappointing, but with that, and kind of not knowing whether or not this is going to be our last show episode. Let's jump into what happened on this episode. Do you want to give a little bit of a rundown?
Yeah, sure. This show and this episode, it's like, how much stuff can you pack in? There's just so much. The Peaches are in the championships. Charlie is now back from the war, so you have this conflict with Greta and Charlie and Carson's own internal turmoil. You've got Max dealing with not only her mom and conflict with her family, but having to leave her best friend behind, this person whom she's lived her whole life with, Clancy, like they're Siamese twins.
Yeah, and her best friend whose husband is at war.
Is at
war. And who we get a bombshell for Clancy's status in the show.
Right. And then, of course, Max going off and joining her team. And I think, for me, the theme of this episode is team and team broadly. It's Max that says it to Clance, but you are my team. And so when we think about Carson and Max having these dovetailing stories, Max wants to find a team. But at the end of the season, what we're finding is her team is her family. And meanwhile, Carson is dealing with actual team. I think that's actually kind of an interesting juxtaposition.
I agree. And I know that we've talked about Max not having much of an identity outside of baseball at times. But I felt like this was a really good episode that showed how much Max cares about those people that are around her. And I thought there was a lot of payoff from the literal family, from Clance, who I would say is also her family, even her sense of working at the factory and what that has brought her in her life. I thought that there was really good payoff, and I was really excited and happy to see Max's arc. Something I'm sure that we're going to talk about later would be the dynamics between Max's uncle Bertie and Max's mom Toni, and both wanting to protect Max, but wanting to do so in different ways and seeing things through different lenses. And yeah, very much contrasted with Carson, who you think her family is back, her husband, but she's moving in another direction. Maybe.
Literally, we don't know which direction she's going in, Emma, because she's not going home and she's not going with Greta.
So where do you want to start first?
You know what? Let's go chronologically, because there's so much to unpack and we often do it thematically, but let's do it chronologically. We start off within Carson's self-doubt, and that's kind of one of Carson's themes, right? This idea of always trying to grow into being someone, mastering her self-doubt, moving past that moment. But she's kind of reverted back into that because now they've lost the first two games. If they lose again, they're out. And Charlie is back. And all of a sudden, she's losing herself in Charlie. I think it's really interesting. My wife pointed out, because we're watching this, and she's like, you know, Carson struggles to establish an independent identity because when Charlie's around, she just defers to him. When Bev told her to exert leadership, she just tried to copy Bev. It was only in those rare moments that she kind of was herself, which is something Greta tells her. Where is Carson Shaw in all of this?
On my first watch, I was not a fan of Greta. I felt like Greta was sort of this manic pixie dream girl type thing, not taking responsibility, flittering around, you know, beautiful, worldly, etc. But in my rewatch, I really liked Greta. I felt really like she's someone who's anchored. And I didn't feel as much connection with Carson, in part because I think we do see Carson always trying to mimic and fall into someone else. And I didn't feel totally convinced, even by the end, that she established herself as an independent person and a leader. We talked about this in previous episodes when it comes to Carson becoming the manager of the team. I'm still not totally sure that she was the right choice. I know it was the narrative choice, but I don't know that they made the argument strong enough for Carson growing into that position. And that's not to say that that kind of growth stops somewhere and like that it's said and done. But still in the last episode, she's working on fighting these demons.
Emma, I have to say, as an athlete, I thought her pep talks were absolutely terrible. I would not have been inspired by them, just personally.
Okay, that's good context. I wasn't sure if it was just me.
No, I had a head scratcher there. Let's talk for a minute, though. One of the things about the conversation she had with Charlie in the hotel room, it was a little clumsily written, I thought, because Charlie blew hot and cold. He was such the perfect guy in the last episode, and now all of a sudden he's the bad guy. But I think when she gives him the money and says, I couldn't open an account, It really drives home the power imbalance that exists between men and women at this time. And in some ways, I wish they brought this concept in earlier, because it's not that easy for her to leave. But it's not just, oh, what will society think of two women living together? Because as you and I joke about all the time, women lived together forever. They were just best friends with Kat.
Super close friends. They specifically requested to be buried next to each other, but it's only because they are BFFs.
Like, you're in an Egyptian tomb with your really good friend doing the husband-wife stance because you're just like really...
super good besties.
Hoes before bros. You know, this power imbalance that exists in the 1940s is institutionalist, structural. If you can't open a bank account, yeah, how are you going to live separately? And I think there's such tragedy in that moment, because why is she offering Charlie wages? I think it's to remind viewers that there are expectations leveled on women at this time period that's not just societal.
And this is where I, again, didn't really like Charlie's character for something being set in this period. When I was watching the beginning of the finale, I was thinking about my original thesis. Right back from our first episode, that this is sort of Broad City, the character that Abby Jacobson played there. And she's kind of imagining the reference to the peaches in Broad City and mixing the modern day with the historical past. And I think if that had been established at the beginning, it would have helped set the tone better. Because as I've said before, I think that Charlie acts like a modern good dude. You know, like if I said to my spouse, hey, I have these professional requirements that I need to take care of. I mean, I haven't had something like winning a championship, but I've definitely had days where I'm like, I have to stay at the office late. I have to respond to some emails. I need to do stuff. My own spouse, he'll be like, okay, that sounds good. Or, oh, that sucks, but I understand, because that's the world that we live in the 2020s. But as I've mentioned before, understanding that at this time, women in some ways were property of their husbands, as they show in the show, she couldn't have a bank account. And then all the stuff that we know from other historical contexts that she comes from. I just didn't find it realistic that Charlie shows up and says, okay, whatever you want to do, I'm fine with. Unfortunately, what I would have expected would be for Charlie to show up, not understand, and say, well, it doesn't matter what you want. You're coming home because you're my wife and I'm home from war.
Right. And even modern expectations. Your husband's a great guy. For the listeners, I've known him for years. He genuinely is a great guy. But I was actually just sharing stories with someone yesterday, and we were talking about how husbands, even in the modern time, behave. I've heard a lot of horror stories of the wife gets cancer, she's going through chemo, she's lying on the couch, and the husband comes home from whatever and is like, where's my dinner? Why didn't you clean the house? It's amazing that even in the 2020s, that there's still these expectations of a woman's role, and men don't always step up. Instead, it's like, maybe I have to make myself a sandwich.
Absolutely. And it is horrifying and unfortunate to me, but yeah, I definitely am in spaces where I hear other women complain about husbands who don't respect them professionally. They don't respect them on an intellectual level. They control the money, especially when you have a dynamic where maybe the husband is working and the wife is not. And so that too, in the show where Carson is making money on her own, is a really big thing. Unfortunately, that can be why it's hard for women to leave when they're in very bad, toxic situations. That goes back to something that's mentioned in the show that we don't hear a lot more about, which was Carson's mom running off. What was the situation there? And then what was Carson's childhood like? Why did her mom leave? Charlie implies it's something about her mother, but was it something about the situation that Carson was grown up in? Was it something about other family members or her society? And then what impact did that have?
Right. There's the implication that she must be a terrible person who has abandoned her family. There's no implication that Carson's dad was abusive per se, but we know that her relationship with the rest of her family isn't great. They don't support her baseball dreams. You're right. We don't know what that was like. All we know is that the male lens that is cast upon this is that she abandoned the family. She abandoned her maternal duties.
Again, it goes back to the whole thing about that's mentioned in this episode. One day having a bunch of kids and that sort of domestic life that obviously Charlie wants to go back to and other people think that Carson should be living in. And Carson torn between what she wants in life, which also is not just figuring out her sexuality, figuring out, obviously, if she's in love with Greta and wants to be with Greta, but also Greta had mentioned earlier potentially wishing that she had children or a family, and Carson has made it clear that that's not of interest to her. So Carson has a lot to figure out, but in this episode, she's mostly focused on rallying everybody up to win that championship, although she does also say something like, we've already won.
In her terrible speech. But before we get there, because we are going to get there, I do want to interject. Again, when we talk about how the storylines are told on this show, and we have our Venn diagram of Max and Carson, when they intersect in this episode, again, it's at night, they're going to play catch. We have this really strong juxtaposition of Max is really riding high right now. She's got her own team. She's got a girl. Everything she ever wanted is suddenly in her hands. Meanwhile, Carson can look at that and realize Carson has a team, but she has lost the girl because now Charlie's here. And she's looking at how carefree Max can be. Whereas she herself now has been anchored. It's kind of like someone tied an anchor around her feet and chucked it over the boat. So they have this conversation. Carson says in some ways she wishes she'd never had the Greta experience because then she wouldn't have known what she was missing. And Max's response is, I would have rather had those 5 minutes of glory and happiness, even knowing the heartache that would follow. And that's how we get to the five, which now a whole bunch of fans have tattooed on themselves. What do you think, Emma? Are you more with Carson that you would have hated to know what you're now missing, or would you rather have experienced it?
I'm more with Max on this one, I think in part because I try to be an optimist as much as I can sometimes be a little bit of a glass half empty person. But I really try to be optimistic and to really treasure wonderful experiences and consider them part of sort of the ladder of growth, and not that it's a linear ladder, but just experiences in your life. And I've definitely not so much had romantic relationships like this, but I've had relationships with people who have died, who it was so meaningful, and that love on more of a familial or friendship type situation was so valuable. And I learned so much that I'm really glad that I had that, even if the loss was very painful. It's really interesting to see how this played out from these characters, because I think this is a real example of where you can see the age difference between Max and Carson. It's not explicitly explained in the show, and I think that they try to make Carson seem younger because of some of the conversations with Charlie about buying a house or thinking about children. Even though we know in real life, Carson and Greta, the actors are around 40. I think that to me, this seemed like that age gap of Max is still very young, has not left home, is at the beginning of the journey, as well as just Max's personality is different. And Carson, I think, is a little more world weary and feeling particularly now sort of sad about where things are. And I can't blame her for that.
I'm with you. I understand the sentiment of at least you'll have beautiful memories, but it's scary to think, because if you put yourself in Carson's shoes, there's the risk that she goes home with Charlie. He says you can never come back. And those 3 months or whatever with Greta is all she ever has for the rest of her life. That's pretty scary too. And I can understand the fear of having these regrets, of having this missing part, or maybe a missing space in your life for what could be another 60 years. That's pretty scary.
I think this gets to also the unfortunate reality that even today, especially for women, they're often told you need to fall into a certain box and meet certain expectations. And I think that happens more for women than for men. Of, well, you should be a homemaker, especially coming from a very close-knit, small community. Everybody grows up to be a homemaker. Everybody graduates from high school, gets married, has a family, keeps a home, knows how to bake a pie, which Carson knows how to do. Even today, there are plenty of people who feel that pressure and who don't get the chance to have freedom to experience things. And it also goes back to if they don't have the money or the time or the support for education, for traveling, other things. Like this taste of this kind of life must be so exciting for Carson because she's never had anything like this before.
Yeah. So let's move on. Let's talk about some of the speeches that are in this episode. Carson's first actual speech that she gives in this episode, it's actually a practice day speech. I think it's really interesting because it's like the speech starts really well. And then for me, it just derails because She starts off with this analogy that they're like this tree growing in Brooklyn, right? That there's no reason that they should have succeeded, that the odds were against them. Despite these odds, did, and they flourished, and it was great. I was there with her. I was like, yes, this is a little bit forced because it's the book that Greta gave you, but yes, I like it. And then she's like, and the other team is better than us. And I was like, no, rule number one in sports is you never say that. And everyone's, that's what all the players are saying. They're like, Carson, what are you doing? I don't know if Abby played a sport, but I'm also just like, you just don't admit that. It doesn't matter if you all know it's true. If you're going to say the other team is better than us, you don't just say like, let's get lucky. You say like, but you know what? Even though they've been better in the past, we're going to prove that we actually are better. Like something like that. For me, I just, ooh, that one was hard for me to listen to. What did you think?
I'm with you. And just for a little bit of historical context, the book that she's referencing, A Tree Grows in Brooklyn, was published, I believe, in 1943, which I think is the year that the show is set, correct?
Emma, maybe they had a time machine. I don't want to make assumptions about this show.
Even when she referenced it, and it is a really beautiful story and a very famous, well-known book about the turmoil of life in Brooklyn in the early 1900s. She mentions that Greta gave her the book and she looks at Greta on that, which makes sense. But I was a little confused why she picked this book and more why the writers picked this book and this story to use in that example at this point in time. It's a very, again, moving account. And I think we all understand this idea of everybody says you can't, but you're the little seed that becomes the great oak. That's a great metaphor. But I didn't think the speech was the best thing for this moment for where the team is. And like you said, it would have been perhaps more impactful if she said, you know, we might be the underdogs, the little team, but we're going to push through and we're going to give it 110%.
Yeah. What we lack in skill, we more than make up in heart or something like that. Although I did like the ending because this idea of be there every moment. For me, as I watched this, you know, the second time preparing for this podcast, knowing the context of this show, not having been canceled, but only getting four more episodes, I was like, that applies to all of us. We are here every moment watching the show, enjoying it for what it is, knowing that a year from now or whatever, it's gone, it's over, it's done. And I think that's true of so many things in life, is that you go into this moment and it's easy to get distracted by, oh my God, we're going to lose, or all of these other thoughts that are competing. But to be in that moment, to step up to the plate and say, wow, no matter what happens, we are in the championship of the very first season of this women's league. There are people cheering for us. The sun is shining. Being in that moment really is wonderful. And I think that was a really good point.
Yeah, I did think that was very beautiful. And the sense that it gives of you need to appreciate all the time that you have because you don't know how limited it will be. It goes back to, again, something I said in the first episode about Carson is this sort of nebbishy type character who's like a little bit funny, but draws from these historical Jewish comedic tropes, because definitely a thing in, I'd say, Jewish outlook, particularly in America, is you kind of only have this one shot. It's not the same sense of, well, if you're a good person here, you'll be rewarded in the afterlife and you'll go to heaven and have that kind of connection. There's more of a sense of, well, we don't really know what comes next. All we know is that we have this moment, and it's important to make this moment count and to try to enjoy things and feel things in the moment, because that's all you're guaranteed in this life.
So, Emma, we go from Carson's speech about pulling together and valuing each moment to confronting Shirley. What did you think about her speech to Shirley?
I'm glad that Shirley got a redemption arc, and I thought that it was a good scene between the two of them in the sense that, to me, it felt like Carson confronting her own inner demons and her fears. When I thought more about the show, I feel like over the course of it, Shirley was sort of that nagging voice inside of Carson that is afraid of things, that's being held back, that's limiting herself. And so I felt like as much as Carson was talking to Shirley, it seemed like she was trying to talk to herself and just come clean to herself. I did think it was a little weird to focus on you shouldn't be afraid of things and still Shirley to go back to, oh, so I can't catch being gay and whatever. Again, with the historical context of this literally was taking place during the Holocaust And I think that probably was maybe more in the back of Shirley's mind potentially than like gay people. But, you know, it is what it is. And I'm glad that they sort of made peace at the end and for both of the characters had a resolution. What about you?
You know, that's such a brilliant take on that because I missed that completely. And hearing you say that, I'm like, oh my God, you're right. She is the representation or the externalization of Carson's fears, but like also just insecurities and concern about what other people think. So for me, when I listened to that, I was like, wow, this is so weird because Carson yelling at Shirley, like, God, what's wrong with you, Shirley? Just eat the dented food. I was like, that would not be compelling. If I was in Shirley's shoes, I would not be like, oh my God, and I'm no longer homophobic. And also now I'm chugging these beans out of a dented can, which of course is what we see in a later scene. But when you think about it that way, yeah, if Shirley is Carson's inner voice, she is yelling at her own inner voice and saying, I won't listen to you anymore.
Especially because Shirley also is sort of a never been kissed character. And I think that parallels to Carson with Carson's experiences with Greta, with obviously being with other women. And so, yeah, that's where I felt like Shirley is a manifestation of these things that Carson has inside. Again, love the acting and humor of Shirley. Did not love the writing and storylines for her. But I think across the board, I would say the acting on the show, I really liked. I thought there were some really outstanding performances. And I wish that we got more time to see all of those characters because there really were so many vignettes that were strong.
And now we're not going to because we only have 4 episodes in season 2. But let's keep moving along because we have so much to discuss. Let's talk about Max and Clance having dinner with Tony and Edgar. And again, this is this idea of this is Max's family. She wants them to be excited for her. And instead, everyone's kind of on eggshells. Max really just wants everyone to be as happy as she is because she's finally achieving her dream. And then, to me, like one of the biggest plot twists of this season, Tony's known all along that Max was gay.
I wasn't shocked at all. You were shocked?
Yes, I was shocked, but I thought it was brilliant because we've talked about in the past how Tony wants to set up Max to have a better life and how we are old enough to appreciate what Tony is doing for her, but also to understand that she's like, look, Max, you're a gay Black woman in America. You got to do what you can. And baseball is a great dream, but that's not going to help you financially when the world comes crashing down around you.
I love Tony. I think she's one of the best characters on the show. Again, as you said, from our perspective of being older, not old enough to have a child Max's age, but just having that kind of time and space in your life where you've seen a lot of things, you've seen a lot of bad things happen. And I thought that Tony bringing in her family's experiences and coming forward and saying, look, I know that some of these things were really hard on you, but I've been trying to protect you and trying to set you up for success as much as possible. I felt very empathetic toward Tony and also understanding, though, that sometimes a person in that role, be it a parent, be it some other sort of mentor or older family member, they also can't understand everything that the person is going through. And so we know that Max needs to go follow her dreams.
Yeah, I like the yin yang of Bert and Tony because Tony, she's like fear, she's worry, but Bert is hope. Tony says life is hard and you should prepare for that hardship. And Bert says, yeah, life is hard, but you have to find joy and you can't just be afraid. You have to be who you are. And if your authentic self makes that harder, oh well. And that's one of the greatest scenes in this episode is the two of them standing on the steps having that conversation.
I agree. I felt like this was somewhere where the payoff was so worth it. And I love that Max's dad is such a nice guy who's so supportive. And so I didn't feel like they needed to have that contrast with him. The way that they set it up between Tony and Bert, brother and sister, but both acting as surrogate parents in a way, was great. And I think it's really the challenge that people face. I mean, I have children. And when you think about your children, it's like, you want to protect them, but you also know that they have to experience some things for themselves so that they can have that happiness. But you know that sometimes bad things are going to come with it. And I think we've all gone through that in life, the highs and the lows.
Something else that I thought was really powerful was Tony carries this wound because Bert left. Bert says, I didn't leave because mom and dad were pushing me out or whatever. I left because you were inadvertently the quicksand pulling me down. Your desire that I conform was too big of a risk to who I was. First of all, that's super powerful on its own just to realize that we could be that person to someone else without realizing it. You know, are you asking someone else to change who they are and you think you're doing it to protect them when you're hurting them? But also because Bert is saying you're doing the same thing to Max. I mean, Bert says that overtly. You push Max away, she's never coming back. But like, so powerful.
I think that this storyline really also gets to this perennial question of nurture versus nature. I happen to think, and there's some research that supports this, that people are born a certain way with certain personalities, and those things can be expressed based on the circumstances that they're in, based on the experiences that they have and how they're supported. But so someone like Max, who is strong-willed, who has a real sense of what she wants and who can be very impatient at times, who can be quick to jump into things and leap before she looks. I think a lot of that is just her inborn personality, but then it's how these caregivers around her are trying to help her be able to express and focus that. And you can either express it in the ways of Max kind of having a short temper and going off on things, or potentially Max channeling that energy into something that she really loves. But yeah, I think that this was one of the best storylines, and overall, Max's growth in this episode, I felt like I saw it. I felt like I wanted to see more over the course of the series, but I'm really excited for her in this one.
Yeah, and we kind of came back to that original energy from episode one between Max and Clance, you know, that energy going to the tryouts, coming back on the train. We saw them again. I mean, I thought the roommate interview at the beginning of the episode was hilarious. I thought them sharing a moment as Max is leaving, that's some of what we're here for, right? And we said it just a few minutes ago, but this is Max's team. This is her family. These are the people that give her that other dimension of her life's not just baseball. It's also her relationships with Clance and with her mom.
And this is where I go back to what I said at the very beginning in our first episode. I think that the friendship is a core element. I think this is where the writing is very strong. Again, we know from Abby Jacobson's very successful show, Broad City, it was a show about two female friends and their experiences. And there was an ensemble cast of characters around them, but ultimately the love story was a friendship love story. And I think with Max and Clance, you really see that. You really see the way the actors delivered it. You see it in the writing. That's something that is beautiful, and I'm sure I've said before and I'll say again, it isn't always on screen. Often we see stories where two women are cutting each other down, they're adversarial, or there's some sort of real tension between them. But just having two friends who are like, I'm going to be here and have your back and support you and love you, even if your dreams are going in a different direction than mine, that is so wonderful. And I think that was one of the best depictions in the entire show.
For sure. Now, A League of Their Own, the original movie, it's a baseball movie. This show is also a baseball show. It's also like not. This episode has a lot of callbacks to the movie. They sing on the steps just like they did in the movie. Now, you have a problem when you have a sports movie or TV show or whatever. Your team, your underdog team, can't win the championships in season one, because then where do you go in season two? So, of course, they have to come up with some sort of reason why the Peaches lose, but do it triumphantly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, Joe, of course, it's Joe who hits the homer that wins the game for the other team, but she sprains her knee and the Peaches carry her over the bases so that even though the Peaches have lost, they still won and they literally rounded all the bases as a team and crossed home plate together.
Yeah, I felt like this was an example of the baseball feeling a little bit forced into the story. Like, they bring it in when there's been a lot of time not focused on baseball. I mean, in this episode, there's been a lot of time focused on Carson's relationship with Charlie, Max, and her family members. There was the locker room speech, but still, I just didn't feel like I was super, super invested in them winning in the championships. And kind of like we've talked about other episodes before, the baseball at times feels like it's just sort of forced in. And that was some of the criticism of the show.
One of the things as I was watching, I couldn't even tell you who played which baseman or which position. And I think that kind of speaks to the fact that the sports aspect was deprioritized. I was watching Greta play first base and I was like, oh, that's what she plays. Wait, but who's their shortstop? And looking at how do people move? How do they run? Ray Gray, who's the relief pitcher, was out playing an outfielder. And I was like, wait, I think she's the best mover. She's the most credible when she runs. And it was kind of that thing where, like, maybe they should have dedicated a few minutes in previous episodes to showing us, because normally your shortstop is a really good throw. Like, there's certain mm-hmm. positions that are considered, yeah. I don't know, higher profile, if you will, than other positions. But other than the fact that they said in this episode that Joe had been their best hitter, I don't know that you could say who was particularly good or not good on the team, particularly because, as I have pointed out numerous times on this podcast, every episode has new members of the team just in the background.
Yeah, I've been looking for that now. Like, yeah. Who's that person?
Exactly. Are they any good? I don't know. Where are they coming from?
But yeah, I kind of wish that they'd had more scenes, maybe of a little bit like baseball bloopers type things. They could have had who's in the outfield and then sort of been like, they fall over each other. Oh, it's funny. Oh, we're going to move you somewhere else. Or, you know, they could have had something in an early episode of figuring out where everybody should be. Or maybe when Carson took over as the manager, she does a refresh. Because this gets back to also, and they don't explain, like, Carson presumably never played on a team before. And so some of these people, and I don't know from the real life stories, but some of the characters in the show, it's like, how did you get to be a first baseman? How'd you get to be a third baseman? If you've not been on a team, you're coming from a tiny town. I think they could have had something showing that being shaken up to establish where people are.
Right. Well, when we rewrite for the reboot of the reboot, Emma, we will bring all of these things in. But, you know, that kind of made me think of some of what we've pointed out as head scratchers or whatever. I noticed in this episode when Max and Clance walk into the screw factory and they're very excited because Max has been listed in the Defender. And you and I had talked about, wait a minute, why doesn't Max know that Reds All-Stars has a female pitcher? Obviously, the Defender is reporting on a female pitcher, so why doesn't she know that presumably Esther has been pitching for the All-Stars for a while?
Yeah, since she seems to have an encyclopedic knowledge of everything baseball, you think she would have known about a female player. Going back to it, I think that I'm excited for Max, but in some ways, you know, you've talked about dating someone on a team can be really dangerous. It can go really wrong and get really dramatic.
So wrong. Yes.
Yeah. So I'm not sure that I really like this pairing.
They can't be together forever, presumably. And when they break up, oh my God, the drama. I can't even imagine. You're on a team of all men and your two women were dating and then they broke up. And now they have to like pretend the other doesn't exist every time on the bus.
Yeah, that is something I hope that we get to see play out in the next season. But I don't think there's going to be time to get to all these storylines that haven't even been wrapped up, that we haven't even addressed.
Right. So let's talk about, because everyone's going to love the scene between Carson and Greta in the kitchen. To me, it's very Abby and Darcy riffing. Like, I just imagine the script is just like blank and it says, say stuff is what the script says, you know?
Yeah. I think that their chemistry is very apparent. Their comfort with each other is very apparent. And again, that's somewhere that I'd say that the show shines when they let these two actors sort of play off each other.
But there's also, Greta says, Carson, you could come with me. And it's kind of this weird thing, like this light kind of goes on in Carson's head. Like, this has never occurred to her. She's like, wait, you mean it? And Greta's like, yeah, I think so. I'm kind of like, wait, you all didn't talk about this? Lesbian U-hauling, this would have been date number two. They're at the pizza parlor and they're like, how many cats should we get and what breeds?
I think we're going to get a lot of unhappy fan mail when I say this, but as much as I love Carson and Greta, OTP, one true pairing, my heart of hearts says that Carson needs to be alone. Carson has gone from her marriage now into this relationship. And what I feel is gut-wrenching is that Carson probably needs some time to figure out what she's going through.
Well, I think that moves us into the final scene, Carson says she can't go with Greta, but she's not going with Charlie. She's going to ride the railroad for
like
months.
An old-timey
with a hobo bag
character. Yeah,
I was thinking a hobo bag on a stick.
A bindle.
But that's what she's going to do. It's weird, though, isn't it? Because she's saying she's going to find herself, but I do wish maybe she'd said, like, I'm going to Chicago. Or, like, I gave Charlie my envelope of money, and now I have nothing. We should have set that up a little better. But yeah, clearly, Abby felt, or whoever wrote that exact part, felt as you did, that perhaps Carson's best move was not to go from one relationship to another, but to go find herself.
No, that's not saying that Carson and Greta can't still be together, can't meet up, see each other again. I would imagine after a very intense season, you might also just want to take a little time to unwind. Maybe she just wants to take a little R&R vacay.
She's just going to go down to Mexico, have some pina coladas.
Yeah, get some cervezas. Maybe Lupe, she's Mexican, correct? Maybe Lupe knows some great places down by the border. Maybe just go hang out.
Yeah, read some books.
Because that's another storyline I don't even think was really touched in this episode. Lupe and Esty. And that really became one of my favorite stories. Lupe became one of my favorite characters. Again, from my first watch, not being totally certain of her. I did really like something we didn't mention when Jess and Beverly have a moment where Beverly gives back the money for the fines that she collected from Jess for wearing pants. And Beverly says, we have to take care of our own.
You know what, Emma? That's because she has her best friend at home and her best friend suggested that she do that. They live together because rent is very expensive. So these two spinsters just...
Beverly just lives with her best friend.
Yeah, there's just one bed.
They are going to be buried next to each other just because plots are so expensive. But yeah, there were so many characters like Maybelle. We just see her sort of being sad and saying goodbye.
Yeah. And then they were all like, wink, she's going to say goodbye to Greta, which is our nod that Maybelle knew what was going on. I feel like Carson should have been like, surely many people on the team are gay. And what would have followed was just like Shirley questioning everyone. She like goes up to Maybelle. She's like, Maybelle. And Maybelle's like, girl.
So have we come to the end for real?
We've come to the end, but one thing I do want to say about that kiss, because I love this kiss outside, is triumphant. We go from their first kiss, which is in a back room. It has that voyeuristic vibe because Max is watching. And one of the things that is very typical of these queer female moments, these sapphic moments, is often the camera is like, watching them from a keyhole or like from a door crack. And you laugh, but I have actually seen scenes shot through a keyhole. Historically, it's like, oh, it's this illicit thing and we're going to film it in an illicit way, kind of like if it was an affair, which technically it also is an affair. And so it's in the open. It's not shameful. It's not hidden. I'm like, yes. And then Charlie shows up and I'm like, nope, there's still someone watching.
It's a callback a little bit to their first kiss as well.
It's such this wonderful jump scare moment at the end, but also I'm like, oh, we're still in this vibe of society is always watching, someone's always judging you.
I don't know. I kind of wonder again with Charlie, because he has this pleasant demeanor, but then in an earlier episode, he said, you know, you're just like your mom, and she ran off. And so I kind of am not sure, like, does Charlie have
a dark side? Are you asking if he has a dark side?
No, I was going to say, does he have suspicions about Carson? And is he sort of trying to put on a pleasant front?
Oh my God, what if Vi is actually Carson's mom?
Oh my gosh, that would be amazing. That would be amazing because Rosie O'Donnell did such a great job. Again, one of my favorite characters. But what do you think? How do you think Charlie is going to react?
Oh man, you know what? I think how he reacts is going to be different from if season two was 8 episodes and they had hope of season 3. Because the problem is, with only 4 episodes left for season 2, they can't spend time on Charlie. It's going to be like, and then Charlie and Carson broke up. They don't have time to waste on drama there.
It's like how we spent so much time with Dove earlier this season. And now, do you even remember Dove? He seems like so forgettable. And his performance was good. Again, the acting has been good, but that storyline just feels forgettable.
Right. It really is. Sorry, Nick Offerman.
Yeah, he did a good job acting. But I think with Charlie, too, good acting. But, like, we're spending a lot of time with him when we could have been spending that on Lupe or Maybelle or Esty or Jess or even Joe.
Joe, yeah.
what Jo is thinking about when she's on the new team and how her new teammates reacted.
You know what? That is the perfect pivot point. Emma, season two, how does the band get back together and what does that look like? How do we get Jo back? Or do they move it away from baseball? And rather than skipping ahead to the next season, now they're like, hey, it's 2 days after where we left off and Carson just got ditched by Charlie. And now like five people have to rally together to go on a road trip to Mexico. I don't know. What happens?
I think they're going to jump it ahead. I think they're going to jump it ahead quite a bit, potentially when the season is just beginning. Maybe Greta went to New York and we see Greta in New York.
She had to. She got that job.
Yeah. I mean, I could imagine it opening with Greta strutting her way through New York City, feeling confident, money in her pocket. And then it's the season. And almost, I kind of would love to see, is Greta questioning going back to the team? I feel like roles could potentially be reversed. Before, it was Greta and Jo making their way through the world and stumbling, and now Greta being on her own for the first time. Now, I don't think that she and Jo have permanently gone their separate ways, but potentially it could be she's on her own really for the first time and she's earning money and had to find herself alone, but she's on the upswing. And Carson maybe has lost that stability. She's separated.
Is it a montage, by the way? Just this 2 minute montage. It's like Mary Tyler Moore, but it's Greta.
Yes, I love a montage. I love a good montage. But I could see it starting with Greta getting the call. The season's back. Team's coming back. Are you with us? And maybe she hangs up and she says no. And then everybody's like, is Greta coming back? What do you think?
I honestly can't even predict because, again, we've talked about how many storylines and just how do you tell the story of Max on Red's All-Stars, but then also Greta and Carson. Clance is pregnant. So many. And I don't know how you whittle that down.
We didn't even mention Clance being pregnant.
Clance is pregnant. Like, they just set up season two to have just as many storylines. So I don't know how you whittle it down and you say, we only have what will basically be 4 hours of screen time. And how do we tell stories of these people? I just don't know. I don't know.
Unfortunately, I think what we've said throughout the show, there are just so many stories and they can't get the attention that they deserve because there are so many plot lines.
Yeah. Well, Emma, I think we have to wrap it up here because otherwise we could just talk about this forever and you could just plan season two in its myriad forms.
I would love to. And you know, that leads into maybe we'll have another podcast after this and maybe we'll talk more about other types of shows, other types of writing. I hope that people are following you on social media. At Les_Dish, because Karen is doing so much. She's funding films. She's writing books. She does incredible media analysis. Absolute must follow account.
Ooh, look at you pitching me. I like it. I like it. And Emma's at Plateless Ordinary. And Emma's just living her best food life.
I'm trying.
So if you want hot tips about how to be a good home cook.
Thank you. And you can find us at PATOF podcast on Twitter, on Instagram, podcast in progress on Tumblr, and our podcast wherever listeners want to follow.
We thank you guys for listening, all two of you or one of you, I don't know, round up to two. It's been fun. We hope you've had fun. And we will be back if A League of Their Own is back.
Yeah.
So catch you on the flip side.